For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Pearly, and this is the African American Folklorist. On today's episode, I speak with Michael L. Jones, author of the book Louisville Jug Music and features writer for the African American Folklorist newspaper. We speak about his launching of the magazine Black Scene Millennium, along with his other endeavors to preserve Kentucky history.
What's happening, blues people? Another legendary episode of the African American Folklorist. And I guess I want to say a recurring guest, but that's not necessarily true. It's the second time we're talking. But I would say, are you a contributing writer or a columnist or a featured writer for the newspaper? You're definitely in the writing room.
It's up to you. I can just say I'm a feature writer.
Okay. Michael Jones is with us today. And again, you've seen, well, outside of the African American Folklorist, where in the newspaper you've seen the great articles and features he's written, he also has other endeavors that he works on and with in writing, books, magazines, curation. And we're going to get into all of these things right now. I don't even know what it's. So, matter of fact, why don't we start with the magazine you brought over here with us?
Okay. It's called the Black Scene Millennium. You could check it out at blackscene.org. And it's actually the rebirth of a magazine from the 70s that was in Louisville. And it's kind of like, looks like a Jet magazine. The original was founded by a guy named Leo Lesser. He ran for a Louisville mayor back in 1972. And he felt like he was the first African-American qualified to really run to be mayor. You know, he had run departments before. He was a civil rights activist, but the newspaper only focused on his race and whether he was there to, you know, try and take votes away from one of the Democratic opponents, and get into his issues. So after he lost, he founded his own magazine, and it lasted for 3 years, but many of the people who wrote for him and worked for his staff went on to be important members of the Black community in Louisville and Kentucky in general. Eleanor Jordan, one of the managing editors, the last one, she had just left Western Kentucky University, and she became managing editor, and she ended up becoming a state senator, and she also was in Paul Patton's cabinet. A student, an art student named Ed Hamilton, wrote about art, and of course he became the sculptor, and he did the Civil War, the Black Civil War monument that's at Howard.
Was he also a Western University?
No, he's from Louisville. Okay. He went to University of Louisville, but Leo Lesser, he just started this thing, and it was a vehicle for Black voices that were kind of on the margins. And he died after the first year of it in 73, and other people kept it going in the community, but it ceased publication in 76. And so it had sort of been forgotten. And one of their lawyer, they had a white lawyer, and his name was Robert Delahanty. And, he had a bunch of copies of the magazine in his basement, and his widow found them and didn't know what to do with them. And she gave them to her granddaughter, Katie Delahanty, who is an artist. And Katie was reading through it, and it was talking about policing and housing and all these different issues in Louisville that were still relevant.
Wow.
And so she thought about, trying to do some kind of tribute or new version of it. And so she contacted me because of my background in journalism and research, historical research. And so we've put out one issue because of COVID.
Right.
But we're planning to do the second issue in January. And I've been updating stories on on the website.
You know, again, I'm never usually in a loss of words, but this story actually is very prevalent in the regards of the story of African Americans, Black folk that made significant contributions, usually forgotten or tucked away somewhere, then there's this resurgence, right? So now, in the midst of COVID, there was also Breonna Taylor that affected Louisville in an extreme way, as well as the entire nation, right? How did that play a role in the urgency to make sure that you guys put this out and do it right?
It did. It made, like, we had started before COVID, before Breonna, and we had kind of put things on hold, but then Breonna happened, and we felt like, you know, that was how we could play a role. You know, I didn't go out and do the protests and everything, but I felt like instead of doing what everybody else was doing and interviewing protesters and things like that, the cover story for the first issue of the Black Scene, I went back to Adrian Reynolds. And this was when I was young, when I first became a reporter. This kid was in the Jefferson County jail, and he got beaten by four or five corrections officers.
Wow.
And he got killed. And so, and there were protests or the usual things. And then it got, his name got forgotten. Mm. And so when George Floyd happened, that brought it back to my mind, because he got killed the same way.
Right.
With an officer's foot on his neck. Mm. And the officer said he was trying to restrain him. And so when I went back and reinvestigated, I talked to his mother. And, you know, she said, like, we would never come to this point with Breonna if people had paid attention to Adrian and kept up the pressure, because she had tried to get a civilian review board started, you know, and to get some oversight of police.
Right.
And so when I was revisiting her story, I ended up finding an ex-police officer who had actually transported Adrian to jail, and she had told me they had beat him. He had been beaten before.
Wow.
He got beaten when he was arrested, and he fought back with the officer.
Right.
So in her opinion, what happened to him in jail was retaliation.
Wow.
So that is in the, I ended up, the mother hadn't even ever heard of this story.
Wow.
This side of the story from inside the police.
Wow.
So that's the story that's in the first issue, because what I decided to do is, like, we're small, and I'm pretty much writing a lot of the stories you'll see from the first issue. So I can't do what a daily paper can do.
Right.
But I have a historical perspective, and I can bring that to it.
Right.
So we say that we use history, art, and journalism. We're combining it to tell the document the story of Louisville's Black community. Mm. And so originally our plan was just to do this for a year. We're going to do four issues, and then we were going to do a coffee table book that would combine all the old issues and the new issues. So since the first issue has come out, there was a big reception. And with the way the media is today, a lot of things, especially in the Black community, are going overlooked.
Right.
So we're exploring some way to keep it going as more like a community project. So we're talking to different, and I would stay involved in some way as a consultant, but, you know, I have a lot of things going on. But so we wanted to revive it and to get it back together. But, you know, it's the Black Scene, and I don't represent all the Black people in Louisville. So I've been working to do partnerships with schools and different organizations to get new writers in
for sustainability.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, I'm starting to work on the second issue. And we're hoping to finally be quarterly, but you know, COVID put a wrench in everybody's plans.
Oh, it sure did. And I mean, quarterly is harder than people think.
Yeah.
The audience, that is. Well, let me ask you a question based on something you just said, because just media in general, news in general, talking heads in general, and when I say in general, I mean more or less not just in the Black community, but the media, news, and talking heads that represent the collective body of America. There seems to be a lot of pushback nowadays from consumers and readers that they don't think they're either, you know, the fake news thing.
Yeah.
Although now there's a lot of alternative avenues to get what was considered at one time real news or the real story, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about that, particularly to the Black community, but right now, why is that a thing? And we can't just keep blaming Donald Trump. It has to have started before then, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I studied journalism at the University of Kentucky, and most of my career has been in the alternative press. And I started out working for Leo newspaper in Louisville, which was owned by John Yarmuth, who is our congressman now. So glad to see that. And I've seen I remember, like, I used to write 3,000 to 4,000 word feature articles, and that was all before the internet.
Right.
You know, and the internet shrunk the news hole, and you also got the 24-hour news channels.
Right.
And, you know, the advertising base isn't there. And then the owners of these papers aren't investing in staff the way that they should.
Right.
And so it's easy to, you know, just tell the surface story. And that Breonna Taylor, if, you know, other people hadn't gotten involved, all they would say was she's the ex-girlfriend of a drug dealer.
Right.
And, you know, it could have gotten ignored. And I've come across a lot of stories that, you know, in the news, they say if it bleeds, it leads. You know, and so most of the stories that you see about Black people are going to be crime stories, except right. for February, when every positive thing, you know, you can think of about celebrate. Black people. But, you know, luckily, you know, with social media, you don't have to depend so much on news gathering organizations. But that's a double-edged sword because of the craft. You know, it's important to be able to go through records and just see the whole craft of journalism. Like, I'm not a blog person. You know? People are just like, oh, you should write a blog. And I'm like, you know, it takes me 3 weeks to really write a story. And so.
So, you know, that's funny. I want to talk about blogs in a second. It's funny. We're going to go around a little bit because, you know, there's a lot to talk about because you're doing a lot. Before we get to blogging, again, you said something that raises an eyebrow. So, the removal of finances or the lack of resources has made it stringent or made it hard for real investigative journalism.
Not only that, it's made it hard for poor people to get into business. Mm. You know, my first newspaper job, I think they paid me $19,000. This is in across the river from Louisville in Jeffersonville.
Okay.
And they said that the guy before me made $16,000 and caught the bus to work. Oh, and lived in a goodness. Homeless shelter.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if it's true. But the thing is, like, you know, a lot of professions now, they expect you to do internships for free and to do these things that if you're like a poor kid, you can't afford to break into it because right. you can't afford to work for free.
That is correct. That is correct.
That's and in so the then line. You get in journalism, especially, you get this one point of view. And then journalism has this thing where they say they're objective.
Right.
But what they're doing is just letting status quo go. Mm-mm. They're not, you know, there's some right. And sometimes there's not, there's right and wrong.
Right. So, you know, that brings up something else, because now we're talking about in some news, in some journalism stories, right? The perception of, and you said if it bleeds, it reads, something to that effect, right? Yeah. So, and how majority of, black coverage is crime, but not being the victim of crime, being the agitator. Yeah. So now when we're talking about something that's supposedly objective, how it affects the African-American community is the perception and the biases that are perpetuated in these stories. Could you talk to us about that?
Well, even it's like what you think to quote, what, you know, even when you talk to somebody, I could talk to you for an hour and the quotes that you pick out, like you're going to play the whole thing.
Right.
But if you're a writer like me, the quotes I would pick out would be different than the quotes that somebody else might pick out and focus on and all that. And so, you know, it's not objective in that way at all. And then one thing I see a lot is that there's not the institutional wisdom anymore or history. Like when I started writing, I interned at the Courier Journal, which, you know, the newspaper in Louisville. And I remember there being all these old reporters that would tell you stories. They knew about this administration. They knew the history of the city.
Right.
And I run into a lot of people. Actually, Breonna Taylor, when it happened, I got interviewed a lot from people outside of Louisville, and they were talking about Jim Crow and all these things that weren't Deep South things, were Deep South, but weren't really the way Louisville developed. Like, they had no knowledge. And so it's like, how are you going to report knowledge? You know, it's like parachute journalism, where we're just going to come in and we know everything. And
so we're at a place, and this actually, again, not just affects the African-American community, but it affects the collective, the nation, because what ultimately you're saying, and I agree with, people are not doing their homework, as they say now.
Yeah. And they don't have, you know, they don't give you a lot of time. Like, I started transitioning out of journalism a few years ago. And, you know, I got more interested in history and writing books. And my first book on jug band music came out in 2014. And so.
And the name of the book is
Louisville Jug Music.
Okay, make sure you'll pick that up.
From Earl McDonald to the National Jubilee.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in to the second installment of my interview with Michael L. Jones. For WKU Public Radio and NPR One, I'm Lamont Jack Perley.